Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
But guess what? UFOs became, that's the perfect meme. Remember, UFO was everything in the media, and it got swept out for, I guess the Archons thought of another crisis like war, just to make sure. And I think this meme really exemplifies humanity, because let's face it, people are so into their own things that whether it's UFOs, gods, or anything else, it really doesn't matter. We're going to create our own reality, as the doomer over here has done it. The book Illusions, got by the guy who wrote Richard Bach, John, and there's one thing where if God were to appear in the sky in the clouds and said, I command you to be happy until the end of your life, most humans would ignore the Almighty. That's how we are. We're doomers. If we're not ready for reality, we're not going to do it. But that was, I thought we'd talk about UFOs, but of course we can talk about anything you want. And at Astronosis, I guess the definition is going to end up being a lot more broader. I know Chris was almost done with his presentation, and we couldn't get to even to a Q&A. Do we have any questions for Chris from last night? Ivan from Zoom, any questions for Chris? Sure.
So Chris, towards the end, I think it was your last slide. Just talking about the symbolism again, the remaining buildings at the World Trade Center.
It's all going to be about 9/11. This is a 9/11 coming up.
Okay. I don't know if it's going to be about 9/11 or not. That's what I'm going to find out. You mentioned it, and I've never seen this before. Between the buildings, there was a Royal Arch, and then there was a bottle.
Yes.
Symbolism of the other things, but that was the model.
Well, that's an excellent question, because, you know, 2001 Space Odyssey is like an enigmatic film to so many people. But to me, like when I think about it in the context of my presentation, I think it's basically the same thing. It's this astral travel through the stars and the constellations and the universe and so on. And to me, it's just like a depiction, a filmic depiction of like what I think a lot of these rituals that I think all this material was based on, like all these myths and scripture and symbolism. I think it's all part of like a ritual travel through the stars, right? So again, I sort of need like audiovisual kind of aids here, but there are certain Masonic icons that have the Royal Arch at the gate of a garden, and then there's an altar with a Bible. So I think in this context, the architects and whoever was coordinating this wanted to reproduce that with sort of a modernistic sci-fi gloss. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's the same iconography, but in place of the Bible, there's now the monolith. And that's, you know, your AAT, ancient astronaut kind of stuff. So that would be my interpretation of it, yeah. I think it was built in the 80s.
So it's contemporary, a little later.
Yeah, but nobody noticed that. Nobody noticed that it was perfectly aligned with the Royal Arch. Now, the other thing, too, that's the Winter Gardens. And if you go in there, I actually saw Robert Fripp do Frippatronics in there. It was amazing. But it's sort of a promenade that's lined with palm trees. And if you know the scientific genus for palm trees, it's Phoenix. So it's all about rebirth and resurrection and all that kind of stuff.
I have a question for Chris as well. If nobody's going anywhere, where did they come from? The UFO panel.
Where did who come from?
Well, whatever you want to call UFOs, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, isn't that the question? You know, I think it's sort of, I think they've always been with us, you know. A John Keel or somebody like that said they were a permanent fixture of our environment. And I believe that as well. I mean, I've seen UFOs and I've seen orbs, and there's no way that those are structured craft. You know, those aren't metal machines from, you know, the Pleiades or something, or Zeta Reticuli. I think they're a permanent fixture of our reality. And when you start speculating about, like, they come from different dimensions and all this kind of stuff, I'm really at a point now where I just try to not impose any sort of scientific gloss on these things, because you just end up with pseudoscience, and it just, in other words, you end up nowhere. So they're there, we see them, they've seemed to have interacted us for a very long time, and that's just the way it is. And I think that maybe their association with the stars is that people would see these lights up in the sky and go, oh yeah, stars, you know, they didn't realize that it was something else.
So do you think anyone has ever been anywhere? Like, do you think we've ever been visited in a physical craft sense?
Well, I'm going to stick to my dictum of avoiding pseudoscience, but I think something interacted with us in a very early time, and I think that sort of haunted us. I don't know where they came from, but nobody's ever gone anywhere from this planet, you know, just and never will.
I never tire of hearing it. Sorry.
No worries. Yeah, and also reminds me of what was either Whitley Strieber or Jeff Kripal in Supernatural said, they're not embedded with us, we're embedded with them. So keep in mind who's in charge of reality. We're just sort of in some dimension scuttling around. So important to know. Go ahead.
Yeah, Chris, thank you so much for your presentation, but one of the recent podcasts you did, you were talking about
your belief that technology, as far as like the deepest, strongest technology that we have, has sort of reached its capacity. I was hoping you could sort of expound a little bit on that, and then how it might relate to sort of advanced or whatever it was you were just talking about, orbs and that, and how our interplay and their technology might be bleeding into our reality, et cetera, et cetera.
I have like a tremendous amount of respect for the scientific method. Like, you know, people say, I believe the science. And that means you believe like whoever works for Corning or Pfizer or whatever evil corporation. That's what people really mean when they say, I believe the science. I don't believe the science. I believe in the scientific method, which I think is the greatest achievement that we've achieved. So I was just discussing with these fine folks here, there's a book actually by Tyler Cowen called The Great Stagnation. So this whole idea of peak tech has been around for a while. And there's actually a columnist for Scientific American named John Horgan, who's also written on this, and that we've not really had any major breakthroughs of the, you know, the epical kind that we were used to following World War II. But even before that, you know, I mean, like, our modern indoor plumbing, rail travel, air travel, automobiles, on and on and on. I mean, these things were just major paradigm shifts, and we haven't had that in quite some time, because all the stuff with like Zoom and the internet and teleconferencing and just all this kind of things, World Wide Web, this stuff was all conceived a very, very long time ago, and it was all developed in its primitive state in the 60s at Xerox Park up in Palo Alto, right? we haven't had any major game changers since. I mean, the first cellular telephone came out in 1983, right? I mean, the internet came out in 1980, you know, TCP/IP protocol was, you know, introduced to the public in 1983. So we haven't really had these major game changers in a very long time. You know what I mean? And all the technology that we use now is all just basically variations on a theme. You understand what I'm saying? So it's not a unique, I didn't conceive of this whole idea. I didn't come up with it. I'm just following logically on what these other people have said. And when they just say, you know, we haven't had the kind of breakthroughs in like molecular biology or, you know, when you talk about space travel and stuff like that. And just because something is, you know, can be formulated on paper doesn't mean it can be sized up to the real world. And I think a lot of the science that we told are science. First of all, a lot of stuff in the scientific and technological popular press is just absolute lies. Okay. And I mean, it just, I'm not saying like exaggerations or spin or salesmanship. I'm saying just pure fiction. Okay. But it's to keep this whole idea of progress going, because that's the carrot. You know, we know what the stick is, but the carrot is like, well, you know, just do what you're told and then we'll all arrive in Tomorrowland together. You know, Tomorrowland is not on the horizon anywhere. You know, this is it. And like I said, because of the fact that this stuff all has to be maintained, and it has to be maintained by people who have pretty lousy jobs, like, you know, fixing tree lines, I mean, you know, the phone lines during hurricanes and stuff, you know, I think it's already started. I think we're already seeing the downslope of it. So, I mean, I've noticed that with computer speeds, internet speeds, you know, I've noticed my computer was a lot slower than it was 10 years ago. I mean, it's a different computer, right? But it's, you know what I'm saying. So I definitely think we've passed peak tech. And if this stuff like the wars and all this other stuff keeps going on, I think we're going to have a much sharper acceleration downwards.
This shitty Jetsons view of the future that, you know, Bill Gates has or whatever about, it's a misread of the upper world. It's a materialist, dull, wrong-headed view that doesn't belong in the physical. It's a childish belief system. Let's, yeah, just to add to that.
Anybody would like to talk on alien technology, UFOs, as we see them today?
I'll have something.
I don't have any real control over the whole UFO thing. I'll say this, though. If you're going to look into this stuff, I would really check out the work of Dark Journalist, who does, I think, some of, or not the best work when it comes to UFO-type phenomena. He definitely debunks the blue chicken crowd with Will Cock and Gooden, etc., Tom DeLong, and you know, Chris is Dark Journalist would be the third of the Boston guys right here, so we'll include him. He could be the top of the pyramid for today. But I want to just make it clear to people who are interested in this topic, don't let them waylay you. This is your reality too, and you have a right to interact with this phenomenon on your own terms. And I say the best way to do that, one of the best tools to use would be to look at the work of Dark Journalist. So that's what I've got. I don't have any grand revelations like a Frank Zappa song.
Yeah, I would second that about Tom DeLong. It just seems that he is perpetrating a vision of a war that ties in with the the new space department, and again to create fear. And what do the archons feed on is fear, and fear spreads from one individual to another. Like a pandemic.
I just will say, yeah, it's like a contagion for sure. And that's like my tool wrote Fear Inoculum, because what spread like a contagion. But yeah, I want to emphasize and reiterate, and I'll give this to Miguel, the idea of causing it to become a threat, like, oh, an unidentified threat. Again, that's what I want to emphasize. And Dark Journalist talks about this. If you come at it from fear, what do you think you're going to get? So don't let the CIA type spin meisters tell you what it is from their Saks Avenue fear department. It's your life and your right to interact with these things on a holy divine way. And it can really amplify your own upwards progression and an upward spiral if you learn this stuff, I think. So again, dark journalist, and it's not a threat if you are controlling yourself and in charge of your own destiny.
Sir. All right. So Peter LaVenda allegedly wrote the Second Secret Machines book with Tom DeLonge, and was it 2019 or something like that, I believe, shortly before the COVID thing started. So they get a lot into RMA in the Second Secret Machine books, essentially arguing that that was the key to how aliens or whatever had genetically modified human beings. It's interesting because LaVenda cites a lot of prominent scientists from the Stanford area and what have you in the acknowledgments at the beginning. A lot of these guys also worked with the same people who helped develop some of the mRNA vaccines, specifically the founder of Moderna. What's your guys' take on them playing up like all the mRNA stuff with the UFO phenomena shortly before COVID broke out and the vaccines and so forth?
Thank you. So what I guess in the magical world we used to be good at was, I was talking about Rupert Sheldrake, who's been on the show earlier. Before all this started, we would nod along with this Cambridge biologist, and rightly so, saying that we haven't got genetics right. We haven't got DNA right. We haven't got RNA right. These things code for protein. They're not, and it's, this comes back to that dumb little Jetsons belief system that we did the Human Genome Project in the 90s, and all of a sudden we were going to like cure everything, right? Nothing. We cured nothing. It was crap. And so whilst I'm quite sure the people behind the development of this RNA platform, that they have every intention for it to replace medicine, right? They think that's what it's going to do, but it's not, because we haven't got whatever the fuck RNA or DNA is right. So I'm not at all surprised. I tried reading the first Secret Machines and got about 18 pages in, and that was enough. So I'm not surprised that there is like, yeah. And I guarantee you that there are people at the sort of beginnings of that mRNA platform project who really do think in that Jetsons belief system that there is something about RNA and aliens and so on. Cause they, and it's not that that's right or wrong. It's that we have RNA wrong. It's whether or not aliens have messed with us. We plainly don't have genetics correctly, because the genetic utopia is 30 years late and it's not going to show up, because that's my version of nobody's going anywhere. But anyway, your turn.
Yeah, what I wanted to add to that is that the people who Peter LaVenda work for, and I don't mean Tom DeLonge, have consistently used alien propaganda as a cover for technologies that they've been working on in perfectly human labs. And one of the things that I would point out is that the whole Roswell story, you know, it shows up at the dawn of the computing age, right? When we have Whirlwind and ENIAC and all these kind of machines. And then it shows up again when at the dawn of the personal computer age, right, with Stanford Friedman and all these other people writing books, sort of reviving the whole Roswell thing. And then it shows up again at the dawn of like the popularization of the World Wide Web. Okay. So it showed up at all these sort of nodal points when there was going to be a big rollout for major technologies. So the people always have sort of this instinctual suspicion, rightly so, of these technologies. But if you can sort of sweeten it with like, oh, well, maybe it was aliens, you know, people are going to be, you know, even just the curiosity factor. So I think that, you know, the people who Tom DeLonge and Peter LaVenda answer to have been playing this game for a very long time.
They look like you at the moment with like the hat. Yeah. Great question from a great shirt.
Yes, indeed. And needless to say, this talk will never be published on YouTube. It's always going to be behind the curtain, because now we're getting into the kind of topics the algorithms don't like. I mean, Greg at THC has one more strike on his YouTube channel and he's done. So how about here? Anybody want to speak to this?
Bruce Lawrence.
I discovered by accident, I have a condition called sarcoidosis that doctors don't really know what it is. But I had to go to a neurologist to check, scan my brain to make sure I didn't have any lesions in my brain. And just by herself, she ran some other test. And she told me, we came up with a red herring. You have a Robertsonian translocation. And I'm, okay, what's that? And this was very close to the beginning of the sequencing of the DNA. So this was new, very new stuff. And she says, well, one thing that it means is that you have, if you father a child, the child will have a 1 in 5 chance of having a birth defect. So that's worse than Russian roulette. And she said that if you do decide to father a child, you'd have to go for genetic counseling. And so in a way, I do think that might, that is helpful to have that knowledge. And so that if ever I do.
A couple of questions from Zoom, Ivan.
Yep.
Oh, go ahead. Well, can we get to just one and then we'll get to you? One question from the audience.
Or keep it fair. Using the example of the U.S. seal, the constellation Lyra is also associated with the vulture of or eagle as well as the lyre. Lyre? 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 Okay. In the Greek context, this is the lyre made by Hermes out of a tortoise shell. This means the U.S. seal is very successful Vega talisman. What, if anything, makes their Vega talisman so much more effective than a Vega talisman that anyone can make with appropriate knowledge?
And talisman makers here, that...
No, it's a Chris question.
Well, so the lyre was made by Hermes, but it was given to Orpheus. And Orpheus, if you know the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, you know, the descent into the underworld and the tragic ending where Orpheus loses Eurydice, he comes back to Earth and he forswears women, and then he's murdered by a pack of maenads who were priestesses of Dionysius, okay? And I think the compounding of all this, you know, very charged symbolism and connotations with the Lyra constellation, I think is a major part of it. But as you know, as I said in my presentation as well, it's also one of the heavenly constellations, you know, one of the cherubim at the gate of the garden. So I think, again, there's a compounding. You know, we sort of tend to look back and look back at like the pre-Christian symbolism and think it's kind of separate and that there was no overlap between the Christian symbolism, and that's not true. I mean, there's even in the early days, there was a tremendous amount of back and forth and gestation and sort of borrowing and syncretism. So I think that the power today of that constellation is due to syncretism, and its, you know, its use in amulets, I think, derives from that.
Thank you. Questions, sir?
Yeah.
Sure.
This is
just a quick add-on to that. Do you know the movie Black Orpheus? Yeah. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It's my second favorite film of all time. I think it won the Academy Award in 1960, something like that. It takes place in Brazil, in the carnival in Rio de Janeiro. and it's all about the story of Orpheus and him going into the underworld and with the great samba music. It's a great movie, and you must see it if you love film.
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
This is directed to Gordon, but anybody else? anybody else who would like to answer, particularly Lawrence, based on his T-shirt, in regards to your story about the 18 dried grams yesterday, people on psilocybin often report experiencing UFOs, abduction scenarios, and other sci-fi themes. Have you experienced such things, and what is your take on this?
Yeah, sure, with and without, right? And again, I'm finding it geographically interesting that the overlap between, we have this idea that shamanism and use of entheogens is sort of worldwide, is a worldwide distribution, but it's actually not. Like literally 90% of them are from the Americas, which is why when it comes to how they understand time, I pay careful attention, because that's like a 5,000 year entheogenic project, and they came up with a calendar. And also when you're talking about the Maya, you're talking about people who have, I would say, at least in the classical Maya, like probably a far more nuanced idea of what Whitley's visitors or whatever you want to call them are. And so I hate to go back to just because I said I didn't like using the word consciousness, right? These are beings like allies and plant teachers and so on that have always been available to assist in facilitation with something that you actually don't need otherwise, right? Like most of the shamanic praxis around the world is more kind of like rhythmic or endurance based. But these particular beings, these particular plant allies that are here, I find tremendously compelling and the information they can glean. I'm very Terrence about this. Like I literally think psilocybin is an alien. If that was the second part of it, like I'm absolutely like they basically said the same thing to me and also kind of said, oh, by the way, like several of the classical Greek gods were literally physical alien, like impressive beings on other planets that are now millions of years old and like dead. They're showing me stuff on, you know, corpses on planets where I'm like, well, that's Mars and that's what have you. So all that kind of stuff that you can get in the entheogenic space, I think is the right way forward. There's been a couple of points in particularly American history. When I learned this from Whitley, that the history of America could have gone very differently during the spiritualism craze of say the late 19th and early 20th century, there were senators who wanted to use federal funding to fund basically channeling projects because they were spiritualists and they actually wanted to like go, well, there's something to this. We as a government are facing the possibility of opening some kind of reliable contact with the afterlife. And if they'd done that, because I believe, well, one, I know that's possible from a contact perspective, but, you know, 120 years and a federal budget gets you a long way on a project, right? And that's something Whitley said. He's like, I think one of the things about the visitors is that they have worked out a way to maintain lossless communication with people in their society who have died. And that's one of the reasons why they kind of look so weird to us, right? Is because they have the sort of acceleration of your existence that can happen when you're in that level of contact. The mushroom kind of says stuff like that. The mushroom will kind of attempt to convey those kind of things to you. So you get stuck in this, well, am I dealing with aliens at this point? And then it's like, oh, I'm dealing with humans in the future. I'm dealing with aliens. I'm dealing with a society that is, there's sort of minimal difference between physical death and not. And in this kind of like big and wild way, we have, this comes back to what Vine Deloria said, we have this tendency in the West to want to atomize and to pin to corkboards, like this is this butterfly, this is this butterfly. And when you're dealing with the spirit world, a language of complexity is more useful, which is why I derive so much medicine from Amazonian cosmologies, because they developed to navigate like the most complexity that you're going to find anywhere, which is this really crowded world in which they live. And so when you ask them or you sort of learn how they conceive of entheogens, we want it to be like, well, what do you think? We want it to kind of like drop down into our simple categories, and it doesn't land. It doesn't like land quite so well. But yes, I do think the mushroom's an alien. Just to pop that in there.
Yeah, and it should be noted too, also in fairy lore is very much like UFO abduction, and not just in the West, Iranian, other countries. So there's that kind of getting back to John Keel and the supra spectrum of these, we're embedded with them.
And the map is not the territory. It's wonderful that we spoke yesterday about drumming to achieve, to actually take us off world, altered states of consciousness. The thing with the map is not the territory is that if you don't in some way travel to the spirit realms, let's call them that for now, then when you pass on, you're not going to know what the hell is going on. Just think about it. My first foreign trip was to Paris, and I learned all the maps of the subway system and everything, and booked my hotel room and everything. And anyway, while I'm on my way from the airport, what do I see but rows and rows of condominiums and a highway with cars that look like cars in the United States? And where was my, you know, the guy playing the accordion and the Paris that I had dreamed of? Yes, we have to journey there somehow. We can't just learn about it, like I've said several times already. We can't just learn facts about it or knowledge about it, information about it, but we have to, in one way or another, experience it. If you watch the video of yesterday, I spoke about my experience with seeing an extraterrestrial in my skull after taking sacred psychoactive mushrooms. And so I don't want to go through that spiel again, but also I have experienced it during a Sufi ceremony, completely sober, and also during a shamanic ceremony with just one drum playing, and I went out there. So you gotta get out there. So when you are actually there, you can orient yourself. I mean, just imagine you're like suddenly, where the hell am I? So
I got one. You want to go first?
All right, mushrooms directly, and I'm going to relate to healing. And also, I just want to make the Twin Peaks reference to Jerry Horn taking too many. I mean, is this cannabis? So, I mean, like, there's something in there to discuss another time. The times I've taken mushrooms have been, I won't say plentiful, they've been few, but they've always been revelatory, and they've always had some insight for me. And I just want to say, like, one of the best ones, when I was 21, I was getting over the one of my first heartbreaks. I'm a Libra, so love is a big deal. And it was hard. And mushrooms was really what pushed me through to the other side. I was touching my carpet. I was just doing the whole thing. And I feel like someone should say, you got to get in to get out before we get too far. But I think that one of the things was I realized as I was touching my carpet, I really remember this. And it was like the mushrooms community. Everything will be all right. Everything is okay. And I was like, literally, like, and so that was what my experience one time was. And I hope that directly addresses, because I think they're a wonderful, if used appropriately in the right set and setting, an excellent medicine.
Good. Ivan, was there another question?
What do you think about the official disclosures coming out? And is it leading up to the often speculated eventual fake official unveiling or visits of so-called aliens?
Chris? Disclosure.
Yeah. I did a big blog posting on Project Bluebeam, which is sort of a very popular internet conspiracy theory from the 90s. And I sort of broke it down and pointed out that all the major plot points in Project Bluebeam, which is the planned fake alien invasion, all came from Star Trek episodes, specifically The Next Generation. So this is something I have the benefit of my years. Okay, I'm a grandfather, so you know, anybody's not a grandfather here, you know, I rank you. I've just been reading about this over and over again for so long, and the ideas that are put across are just so preposterous, like beaming projections onto the sodium later and so on. You know, I think that if they were going to do something along those lines, that they would actually use actual craft, because we do know that they have rather exotic craft prototypes that they've been flying around in the Nevada desert and so on. But I think at this point in time, I think, you know, the way that this whole DeLong operation was just such a belly flop, I don't think they were even going to bother anymore, because we could have a faked alien invasion and the reaction to it would be just like in that meme, like, you know, whatever, I've got a lot of things going on right now.
The need for the excuse is sort of changing as we move into war with Russia in particular, because it's always been, they've always trotted out like the Northwoods ridiculous stuff whenever in particular the US military needs to make a big move that might need some kind of metaphoric air cover. It's like, well, maybe we'll trick the rubes with an alien story. We move into a world where that might need to be the case. I think that's what the DeLong thing was for. I think they're expecting a Clinton presidency and kind of like bringing this inevitable war with Russia forward. And so I think there was going to be air cover there of like these exotic craft we have. And I think that's literally what the 2017 New York Times stuff was and the rest of it. It was, we may need to roll out some of the stuff that we're not supposed to have. And so I think that's the inevitable. If we get disclosure, it is a PR campaign for war. That's what it is.
Ivan, could you put that other graphic I sent you? I think this one's, yeah, I have another meme. What would a conference be without memes? Let's see. This one's not the Doomer, it's the Soy Boys. We love Soy Boys. There you go, that's perfect.
Is that what they call it?
Or Soy Face. Yeah, okay. Sure.
I was struck by how it was 2017 would have been the period where they were filming the X-Files that came out in the 2018 time period, which was exactly where they had aliens flying over and mass pandemics happening. And that's just an interesting timing. I don't know what to make of that. But let's be honest here. What is disclosure? You know, is it just, I mean, like, think about this. When has a government ever given up the right to deicide? Or excuse me, what's the demos? I don't know. The word for government killing people. When has your power ever given up power? If knowledge is power and secrecy is power, do you really expect disclosure, or are you just someone who lives in a paddock? So the question is, when are you going to disclose for yourself what's really happening? Because the more of us who join together in that kind of atmospheric kind of intentionality, fuck the government. So that's basically what I'm saying. You don't need disclosure. You are your own disclosure.
Thank you, Nate. I also think about the other. And isn't that what extraterrestrials are? Aliens? They are alien. They are the other. And if... like Nate says, if we're honest with ourselves and with each other, we are afraid of each other. Human beings, we just naturally have this thing where we were even talking about what happened with the whole matriarchy versus patriarchy thing, and how did that go back and forth, and why? What was the reason for that? And I think it has to do with the other, and this goes back to going down into the underworld, into our unconscious to explore. We can be sexually attracted to certain people, and we can feel love towards certain people, but isn't love hate? I mean, anybody, but I'm sure everybody here has been or is in a relationship, and you know how it can turn like that by just a look, a one word. Suddenly, the most beautiful dinner experience is people screaming at each other, even to the point of violence. And so this, you know, I'm a super big fan of OVNIs, UFOs, unidentified aerial phenomena. But also, I try to look at it from a psychological point of view, and I think of it as we must consider the concept of the other. Each of us is very different, other. Since we're babies, we learn to see, well, there's me, and then there's mommy. And while we realize there's a difference, and then daddy takes us away from mommy, but he shows us the world, but then the scary things in the world is the other. So it's just something I think about. Thank you.
Tool lyric, which says before, he says, and this came out August 30th, as I mentioned in my presentation, 2019, before the Rona stuff, all right? And he says in the lyrics, you don't want to breathe the light. You fear the light. Fear the light. Fear the breath of the other. So they're associating the two lyrics, breath, light. Because remember, memory is basically light in water. Mem, water, ori, light. So it is light transmitted through water. I mean, that's an idea. And so just to say, the tool lyrics are always ubiquitously useful in these times. So it is, whether some of us like it or not. So it says, fear the light, fear the breath of the others. The deceiver says. So these are things you can look into on your own time. The second track is called pneuma, which is, of course, the Greek word for the breath or the spirit. So there's more there, but don't fear the others. Let's find a way to accept ourselves and then everyone else. I think it starts within, though.
Except the Irish. F the Irish. Never. Go ahead.
You can say what you want.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Thinking about the disclosure question, and Chris, you mentioned the suppress technology that they have. And I was thinking about a Charles Eisenstein essay that I read recently. And he's talking about sort of how to think about the future and how to get out of these predicaments that we're in. And he talks about that we have to think in miracles, We have to start imagining miracles. And I know there are miraculous technologies out there, free energy technologies, anti-gravitic technologies. I'm curious about if anybody has any thoughts on orgone technologies. I've been hearing about orgone being used to kind of combat the weather weaponry and other kinds of weather effects that we're experiencing right now. But just sort of an open question about how we might imagine miracles into the future, whether that's physical technologies or spiritual technologies or philosophical technologies or dream into the future with us.
I spent a year doing the Wilhelm Reich, a new form of the Reichian therapy called Radix that I highly recommend. And the first thing that my teacher taught me, she was also from Brazil, and she taught me to breathe, which I spoke about at length yesterday. So she said, you know, just bend your knees a little bit. Now, this is to experience orgone, of course, and to bring orgone into the body. And so I just started breathing, and she is very, very tactile. The therapist touches you all over practically. And she just grabbed my chin and pulled it down. And I started breathing like this. And she said, no. Like, and I was like, oh, that's enough. I'm getting dizzy. She says, no, when you get dizzy, just think of the bottom of your feet. And it works. So there I am just standing, and for about 15, 20 minutes, all I'm doing the first day is then she had me lay down, and she had me breathing the same way, and she was touching my stomach. She's going, okay. She says, but what's happening with your chest? Your chest isn't moving. And you know, Reich talked about that there are bands that we put emotional experiences into muscular systems of our body. And he had it divided up into seven groups. So anyway, she got my chest moving, and we did all sorts of different work together, but always the breathing. And then she got me moving as I was breathing until it reached a point. She had me move my head back and forth while I was laying down. And then she said, just kick your feet like this. And so I'm like, okay, all right, I'm doing this. And then she says, like, slam your hands down, your fists down. And all of a sudden, all this pain and agony and tears came out of me. And I felt a sensation that I remembered that I felt as an infant. Some taste in my throat that I remember just as an infant. It's funny because we were in a yoga center, so everything was so very peaceful and incense burning in the main store. And the whole group, often in Radix, we practiced together. So we're screaming and crying, and it was just such a contrapuntal to the piece of counterpoint to the piece of the yoga center. Now, I did see orgone in the sky after various sessions. No, I don't know if, you know, the expression seeing stars after you're knocked on the head or whatever. I'm not sure if I was seeing stars, quote unquote, or if I was seeing Oregon. But it did dramatically change my life that year. It was extremely painful, but it worked. Just very quickly, one of the very first things she taught me, she says, take my hand. Thank God the floor was padded. And she says, okay, just stand on one leg and hold my hand. And I thought, no big deal. Okay, I can do this. And gradually, my leg starts to shake. Of course. And it's shaking more and more. And then all of a sudden, something goes on in your brain like, holy fuck, I'm going to fall. I'm not in control of my body. Now, that was a miracle for me to suddenly realize that I am not the master of my body, and whatever I want to do, I can do. No, my body will say, that's enough, baby. You're going down. And eventually, she just guided me fairly soft landing. But yeah, I did collapse. She wanted me to experience the collapsing. And so maybe we all need to experience collapsing and to have more humility to realize, I don't know. But to go into like the his cloud buster and almost everything, as you probably know, all his written materials from his laboratory are still top secret. So I think, like Nate, you were just saying, I think it was you, that this stuff Reich's material is still top secret. So what the fuck are they hiding? What are they keeping from us? Thank you.
I want to say to your miracle question directly, I want to mention Hof and Grof, because that's obviously Wim Hof and Stanislav Grof. And I don't think I've ever heard their names together like that. So Hof and Grof. Yes, I know. That's what it is. We got to have this said out loud. And they're both breathing technologies. So you can use both of those people's different techs. Like Hof is, obviously we know Wim Hof. I think we know. But Stanislav Grof did the whole thing with the circuits and the prenatal imprinting and stuff like that. But to miracles, to answer your question directly, I mean, I'm 5 degrees Pisces rising. I'm super sensitive and empathic. For me, I would like to see more instantaneous people, like two people coming together and just letting trust happen in a way that's both healthy and respectful for boundaries without getting too hippie-ish, but also with people who are able just to like enter into, you know. And I mean, I believe that we're going to be entering into a great turn, like the Alex Gray art on Fear Inoculum, which is basically two paths. People who choose the organic in permaculture in Charles Eisenstein, and the people who will choose or whatever the transhumanist bullshit dystopian, which Miranda in The Tempest, of course, said, oh, what brave new world with such creatures in it. So I think that's the miracle, is to live in the organic timeline and to be empathetic and to truly be the strongest version of ourselves possible.
Thank you. Talk about miracles.
So most days I agree with Chris, is no one is going anywhere, like 80% of the time. Where I don't, and it's because one of the things he refuses to look into is actually the money behind it. And I've learned a lot of this from Catherine Austin Fitz, right? But the second half of the 20th century is a story of a preposterous amount of money going missing and the development of a legal infrastructure to hide whatever it is that 21 trillion plus is paying for. And it's genuinely an open question for it. Because if you give me 21 trillion in 70 years, I'll give you a flying saucer. I'll buy myself an island, but I'll give you a flying saucer, right? So it remains an open question. The logic and the metaphysics of nobody's going anywhere is tight, right? But there's 70 years of 21 trillion and this kind of giant secret space program black hole in the story of the second half of the 20th century. So as for like what tech they have versus how we move into a miraculous world, I don't know what's in there. I don't know if we ever get it out. Who knows genuinely what's in there, right? But I do think that we get to be the next breakaway civilization. If you actually look at what is available from a modality perspective for everything, for food production, for how we house, for all of it, that stuff is available and more, I think more, it's more beautifully connected. It's that Charles, more beautiful world our hearts know is possible thing, right? Which is you don't go, there's not going to be one esoteric academy that you go to learn like the right way to do housing and the right way to do what have you. It can't work like that because that's a top-down idea. And the top-down idea is actually the thinking that's the problem. So I think the miraculous world, we just decide to do it. We just decide that we're going to have our own healthcare system. We're going to have our own modes of exchange with each other and just do it. And we're in sort of non-local contact on a digital and whatever else basis anyway. And so that's kind of where I'm at with like whatever it is they have, if they have electrogravitics and free energy and so on. I think probably they do because good Lord, there's government wastage, but there's 21 trillion of wastage. Like, give me a flying saucer if I give you 21 trillion. And so that's kind of where I'm at with it, which is I have no idea what's in there, but I don't need too much of it at the moment. I think there's so many amazing, I even hesitate to use the word technologies in it. And that's kind of my story. I think it's we can just be in that really, be excited to step into that our own breakaway civilization.
First of all, I just want to say to the Zoom audience, the reason why I look like this is not because I'm auditioning for the rhythm guitar role in Suicidal Tendencies, but I had I had an extended migraine episode that is making me extremely light sensitive. As to your question specifically, I think what's going to defeat a lot of these technologies is the laws of physics. I think that, again, when you start to look at scaling these things up, you know, it's a big difference. There's a big difference between able to do things on a microcosmic level in a laboratory and then doing them. You can only duplicate natural conditions so much. And I think that the laws of physics are really going to defeat a lot of these actually preposterously science fiction kind of plans that they have. And as far as what Gordon is saying about the 21 trillion, I just don't think that once you get to the trillions, I don't think that money is real. I think it's fake. So that's pretty much how I feel about it.
I wonder, do you have any ideas of how to preserve knowledge in a decentralized and sort of accessible way for most people?
Just to go back on the topic of...
do you mean, so how to preserve knowledge? This is interesting, right? Because it swings on your definition of knowledge. So do you mean information? Do you mean like how do we retain the complete works of Shakespeare? No, it's a real question because like at least a third of animistic is about exploring the fact we've just ignored ways of knowing and ways of learning. So a friend of mine, Marcus Matafera Lloyd, who's Maori, basically re-brought his parsite, his ancestral parsite, back into the living by just doing the work of it and actually using it, what we would call an intelligence of the heart process to find things out during that excavation and rebuild. And he found things out that were he didn't know, like his intuition was telling him, sorry to use that word again, where are you, to sort of do things like dig a hole, put some hot rocks in it and build it in this certain way and basically have a steam room, right? And he's like, that's a bit weird. I didn't think that's a thing our people did. So we built it and his cousin's a Maori historian and he visits one day and he's looking at this parsite. And he's like, oh, cool. That's one of these, I forget the Maori word for it. That's one of these Maori spas, right? This Maori sauna. And he didn't know that that was actually a technology that they had. But in the process of bringing that parsite back into the living and doing it with that intentional awareness,
he somehow got that information. And there's a bunch of stories like that in animistic. So in this kind of like, how do we preserve information? Another way of asking that question is, how do we learn things? And how do we learn things moving forward? Because we are moving into a world where even sort of storing things with electricity and silicon, whilst that might be its own kind of unreliable, you're also going to be facing access challenges as we move into, like, you know, digital IDs and so on. So the idea of keeping everything in the cloud is absurd. But I do still think the better question is, how do we learn how to learn rather than how do we store knowledge somewhere? And that's, yeah.
But how would you share the information with another group of people, or how would you share it with, let's say, like, other generations? Maybe in three generations' time, how are you going to share the knowledge of a certain technique?
In that case, the past site retains the knowledge, and that's what you find in indigenous societies, right? So the sacred mountain preserves the knowledge. The sacred mountain is the library. And so if you teach people, if they learn how to learn, that means they can be in connection with the mountain or the past site, and they get the information. And this, again, comes back to that why I'm only half interested in remote viewing is a cognition thing, right? Like, however remote viewing works, like, if we're sort of, we have all these 19th century esoteric words for it, like Akashic records and so on. But this idea that there is a recording mechanism baked into the cosmos seems broadly correct, right? So the question then becomes, well, not how do you share the information? It's how do you show kids how to learn how to learn? So it doesn't necessarily, we're almost like replicating something. It's a redundancy in the universe for us to store information digitally when that information is in the universe. Like, the question is, like, how do you unlock it? How do you actually access it? And that's one of the things when we talk about, like, quote unquote technologies that I want to see in our breakaway civilization. I want to see that modality, that way of seeing a mountain like a library as normalizing back into the so-called West. But good, great question.
One way to do that, I think, is, as we've done throughout history, is through lodges in secret societies, interconnected people who actually are in the same building in presence of one another, who know each other and care about each other and trust one another, making our own communities. We don't know what the future is going to bring. All of us up here can speculate, but we've seen lodges more or less work for centuries. And I'm not saying it's the answer. I'm saying it's an answer, or potentially one. It might not be, right? But I think that one of the ways to do it is to pass it through groups. Chris wasn't here earlier, but you know, if God's such an ass, then what's wrong with breaking into heaven through the back door? But that would have to tie in the first podcast. But what I'm trying to say is that all of this knowledge that we have, especially, and I'm referencing obviously the secret society that was mentioned in that talk, because I happen to have a differing view on it, as I am a Mason, so it's kind of, I would have a different view on it. But I think that lodges are one way to pass down actual information without it being, because the outside invading forces will have a harder time corrupting it in one way, is one thing to say. But there's other ways, but that's the only one I'm going to mention right now.
I guess I've been thinking throughout this conversation, I've been reading a lot of astrologer and channeler Barbara Handclough. And I brought her book with me, The Pleiadian Agenda, which actually speaks a lot about the Maya, and just in a broad sense, just these deep sense of deep time and cosmological cycles, and this way that humans are within a bigger spiritual war of light and dark beings. And she, in the book, she's kind of channeling this Pleiadian goddess Satya, who's delivering a transmission of our own history and cellular memory back to us. And one of the pieces is understanding that the sort of archons, sort of dark forces, have cast a net over this realm. And one of their tricks is that they take these stories that are, you know, very deeply core to who we are, and they distort them. And that, like, they don't have the power to create their own stories. They have to take our stories like that of Jesus, for example, and twist them to manipulate us. So just, I've just been thinking about that piece a lot. And then, you know, it's Wilhelm Reich wrote a book called The Mass Psychology of Fascism. And in that book, his theory is that, well, fascism is really something that's held in our nervous systems and in our bodies, and is just the trauma of culture passed down. And humans, you know, have the unfortunate habit of making the archon's job easier for them by continuing that through culture. But I've really been connecting to her work in this sense of, I mean, she's talking about things like, you know, the earth is moving into the photon band and we're getting flooded with light. And she and all these other channelers are tapping into these light beings who are here to help us. But that piece about like connecting to our own stories and cellular memory through direct experiential knowledge rather than information passed down, and doing it through the body and through so many spiritual technologies that seem to be coming more and more just in the past couple centuries, the way that people's awareness has been opening to these realms. Yeah.
I would urge everyone to read the Bruce Codex if you haven't already done so. It's not in the NHC, but it is a true Gnostic text that was discovered, 1796, something like that. And certain people had access, like Jung had special access to it. And in the Bruce Codex are actual rituals that the Gnostics performed. So if you're interested in learning about what they actually were doing when they weren't writing their apocalypses and gospels, the Bruce Codex is the place to go. What I'm hearing reminds me of Alahenes, who was called the Stranger in the Bruce Codex. And he was also called part divine, part human. He was also called alien. And this makes me think, like you were saying, that that we're involved in something much bigger than even what we think is like, oh my God, this is pretty intense stuff here we're talking about today. But there is even a bigger picture that's happening, and that maybe they are also light beings, good extraterrestrials who are helping us, who are actively helping us, and who do not want war, who do not want us to do something stupid. It has been said that our nuclear bombs disrupt their dimension, and they hate that. It's worse than they hate that. It's very dangerous, and that's why they started coming here in mass droves in around 47. The 45, 47, such a fascinating period of time. Crowley passed away, and then all of a sudden we have these flying saucers in the sky, and so this is a very interesting time. But I would say that there may be beings that Alahenes may not have been one being, but it might be like a title, like Merlin, they say, may not have been like one person, but Merlin may have been a title for a certain level of wizard or whatever, a Celtic person. So please read the Bruce Codex. You'll love it if you haven't read it.
I just forgot to say too that Barbara Hanclaw's grandfather was Cherokee, and I had brought this up in part because he warned her that, or spoke to the way that indigenous peoples used oral traditions because of the danger of writing things down, of the way that knowledge can be manipulated. And, you know, he was sharing with her, just the spiritual technologies that ancient people, like pre-cataclysmic people, had, and just the fact that that knowledge was held, you know, not that many generations back, and is held by peoples around the world that respect the earth and those traditions. I think that's just, yeah, that's powerful to remember that we have that power. Yeah.
I quoted The Wind Is My Mother as the final slide of my presentation. And just what you said there, we're called the paper tribe, because it's like, what are you guys obsessed with? Like, this is really dumb. This is a really dumb and flimsy way of doing things. But he learned, the guy who wrote the story of his life in The Wind Is My Mother was told as he was growing up that white people are the paper tribe.
I think I was going to mention something. I'm over here.
Oh, there you are.
Hey,
I was like,
hi.
Hello. Arrived. They've arrived.
I think I'd like to refer to that doctor, woman doctor that you had a Zoom conversation with the other day.
Sid. Yeah, yes. Dr. Rob.
Right. It seemed to me that she was really focusing on a very simple and non-complex idea, whereas when we're speaking about knowledge, I mean, it is very nice that we were able to see the Nag Hammadi Library and was found and all that wonderful stuff. And everything that we're talking about is like, you can read this book or that book or this book or that book. But it's a very linear idea to save knowledge as if we're passing it down from one generation to another. I think the time has come where we have to realize, I think what Gordon was saying and Sarah was saying also, is that we have to go vertical and we have to expand our awareness so that we can access things like the Akashic records. So I emphasize transcending, as Sid did, to a point where it was very simple, and to kind of stop going linear, saying, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's important to, you can do both. I mean, you transcend, and then you can enjoy the shit out of everything, you know, we're all talking about. You can go UFOs, you can go archons, you can go anywhere you want to go. But you got to get to the source so that you merge with that reality, which is a non-changing reality, and then you're stable. So as long as you're stable, you know, you can enjoy yourself.
Stability. Yeah. Any other questions? Ivan was abducted. Oh, there he is.
Just to respond to that, there is a Tool album called Lateral Us, and when you change the song listings, you get a new order and you get this album called The Holy Gift. So basically lateral thinking, right? Or end-based thinking, or just like kind of linear thinking is what they're arguing against. And so when you rearrange an album, you're literally using you're using several layers of that upwards thinking. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, I thought I'd just mention that to everyone. The album reforming itself is actually an act of that vertical evolutionary upward spiral type of energy. So I wholly agree with you. I love the upward spiral idea. And I think that we should all reach for our own highest ability of consciousness and help others to do the same. So I don't know. That's what I got.
You said you practice the chant.
Yes.
You want to chant. To
some degree.
Thank you. Wait.
Yeah. Okay. Can't really.
Oh, no, I wouldn't be here if I did.
Yeah.
So from John F., could there be many technological breakthroughs that have remained hidden for the benefit of an elite in a breakaway civilization?
Maybe. I think it's interesting. You're talking about miracles. Have any of you guys watched the movie Arrival?
Yeah.
It seems that movie, I think, is probably my favorite UFO movie, because everything that was supposed to be miraculous, aliens, time travel, memory recall, prophecy language, ends up completely mundane and part of the universe. It's no big deal. The one thing that is miraculous is Amy Adams deciding she's going to live with her daughter and watch her die of cancer, that it was worth it doing it one more time. I think that's where the miracle is. It's what, like, the Nag Hammadi text, Asclepius, says we humans are superior to the gods because we are mortal. So I think that's where the miracle is, our mortality. Everything else is really just mundane. Technology. Back to the question, any technologies are heading for us?
Maybe. This is the thing. Like, some days I think that, and some days I think, can you really have a $21 trillion boondoggle? And yes, probably. I do genuinely think that. We have a history of it in the military, obviously, of things being built and then eventually kind of showing up, right? So to Chris's point, which is completely correct, that the second half of the 20th century's technological innovations are more disappointing than you realize until you think about them. But even the ones we did get, like every aspect of the iPhone began as like part of secret military projects and then kind of tipped out into the real world. So that's literally how we appear to get innovation down here at the moment. Now, does that mean that there are underground bases with electrogravitic craft? Like, that's a genuine maybe. Like, and it's not just I can look at the money. I got to meet people over the course of my career who are like, yes, that's absolutely the case and what have you. But by the same token, it's still a maybe.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, you know, there was a guy on YouTube lives in Las Vegas who was, for a while, was filming all these very strange things flying over, you know, the mountains there and coming from Area 51 and so on. So, I mean, it's clear that there are things, but the question becomes is are they applicable in a battlefield situation? Are they applicable in any kind of practical situation? This is what I'm talking about. There are a lot of technologies that have been developed a while ago that just aren't practicable. They don't have applications in the real world.
Yeah, I'm not as convinced about the limitation of the laws of physics, though, because I do kind of think we're only operating with half the laws of physics. But I agree completely. Like, we don't know how much a Raytheon flying saucer costs to build, because if it's like $5 billion, we're not going to bomb Russia with flying saucers. Like, you can't do it. Like, if it requires not just rare earth, but like off-planet stuff that these alleged memory metals and other things that the kind of UFO teams are interested in. If it requires things that we don't have that much of, as you say, it's not like you can scale flying saucers. You might have a couple of them. And so I have no idea. Like, again, it depends on what day. The paper trail is there for a complete breakaway civilization, but who knows?
And Atlantis is real.
Wait, that was in my presentation. What are we talking about? Dark Journalist talks about the COG, which is the continuity of government. And that's something that continually seems to pop its head up. And that could be something that would be used to just hard stop this government. And that's what was happening on the 9/11 panel. That was happening on 9/11 when they tried to do the whole thing where they had to get George Bush back to a certain place so he could reassert control of the country. There's something to that, but I just wanted to mention the continuity of government issue when it comes to these kind of things with this breakaway civilization via John Rappaport, Catherine Austin Fitz, and Dark Journalist. These are people that talk about this immense amount of money going missing, like Peter Dale Scott, too. And I just would encourage people to look at Dark Journalist's work when it comes to this kind of continuity of government or breakaway civilization.
Then there's the Higgs field. And that has permitted scientists to actually beam thoughts into another person's head. They've been successful with that. And I've read that somewhere around 1904 or whatever it was, the New York newspapers reported that the Wright brothers' flight was a hoax. And they had to detract that and announce that it was real. And my adopted father was the head of quality control on the lunar module. And he would wake me up in the middle of the night and tell me various secrets about what was happening because our phones were bugged. We were being followed. I mean, he was like ultra top secret. And he put his name on a little piece of paper or something, and he put that into the base of the lunar module, and today my father's name is on the moon. And I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of him. May he rest in peace. And I'm honestly, maybe I didn't hear correctly, Chris, you are a grandfather, I understand. Did you say that all the laws of physics have been discovered?
I don't know how to say physics have been discovered.
Please speak.
Yeah, I don't know if all the laws of physics have been discovered, but I think the laws of physics that we have discovered preclude, you know, a number of these more speculative science fiction technologies that we hear about, you know, on the internet.
Okay, one last question before we wrap it up.
Speaking of, I'm in broad agreement that we're kind of past the hump on technology, but there's still stuff in the pipe. So fusion would be really radical. It's been in the pipe forever. Is it pie in the sky BS, or do you think there's some reality to the that actually coming to fruition?
I can't speak to it.
Yeah. Do you mean cold fusion? Yeah. I remember very clearly, I was working in New York, I was working in the Empire State Building when there was a University of Utah cold fusion experiments. Was that what it was? There were a group of scientists that had, back late 80s, early 90s, announced successful cold fusion experiments, and then it was just kind of shuffled away. I want to relook at the timeline again, but I remember thinking at the time, like, yeah, they probably did achieve cold fusion, and you know, Exxon and Mobil and Sunoco and all those people came along and said, no, you didn't. that great Simpsons things, fossil fuels, use them and nobody gets hurt. So I think that there definitely are experiments like that that have been successful that have probably been covered up. But the question again becomes a question of scale. You know, I mean, maybe you can use a certain amount of energy to produce a cold fusion reaction, but is it economical to do so on a much larger scale? You understand what I'm saying? So I think that I always try to look at the psychology and just look at how the cover up or the denials, you know, and I sort of equate the two with a lot of these things, how this came about and how this was all sort of, you know, perpetrated. So, you know, to answer your question, I do think that there have been successful experiments with cold fusion, and maybe the question is whether or not that knowledge wants to be released, or it's applicable, you know, on a mass consumer scale level. But again, I mean, this is 30 plus years ago, so who knows, you know? I mean, but this is the point I'm kind of trying to make, is that if we had a successful cold fusion experiment, it was 30 plus years ago, and, you know, and we haven't really heard much about it since. And there are a lot of things like this, because, you know, I used to follow this stuff pretty religiously, you know, and it's why I came to label DARPA as a subscription to the X-Men and a fax machine back in the day. Because, I mean, they're just announcing all the most nonsensical projects that never, ever saw the light of day. So, but again, I mean, I think that most of the theoretical science has probably been accomplished, and then we face that giant sort of Mount Everest of getting from theoretical science to practical science.
I'm a professional pianist and composer. For those of you who grabbed a handout yesterday, there is a link to my music that you can listen to, my original music. And I remember I started studying when I was 6 years old, the piano, classical piano. And to echo Miguel's words, my piano teacher said one of the greatest things about live music is that musicians can make mistakes, that we're vulnerable, that we're not these machines, that we're not perfect, and it's that delicate balance that happens when one is performing that's so beautiful, because somebody, I love to improvise, somebody may do something a little different and like take me completely off guard, and I have to like come in somehow and match that or complement that, and it is the beauty. We but look at Michelangelo's David. I mean, our humanity is our greatness. I would agree with Miguel totally.
You also?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any more than an elbow in a, so I'll tell you what I think, though. And I mean, like I said, my UFO group, two guys who worked with my dad back in the 70s, they were talking about how they were working on stuff just at Bose and like other parts of the lab there. I have no reason to doubt that there's not already this. I mean, also, we don't even know about the energy in our own bodies, like Kundalini and stuff. Like, let's start there, like I said, within. But I think that there's absolutely some way to tweak the physics so that we can actually have that perpetual motion. I don't know how, and I know it's not economical because, you know, not from the greedy perspective. It is, if you look at the stories of Atlantis, they actually had that kind of energy. And then this is just the story through Casey and stuff, but the dark magicians, the Belial group versus the Amelius group. Amelius wanted basically like peace and free things and like a good balanced world. And the Belial group was basically the archonic driven ones. And they use that energy, which can be like used to power everything wirelessly or destroy the whole Atlantis. So that level of tech would probably have that level of danger attached to it. But I don't think anyone in this room really has that answer. Or else I'm not getting paid enough.
Well, thank you. Well, I think we better wrap it up. It's been a fascinating discussion. As soon as we do this, we're just going to jump off on closing. Just be Ivan and I. We'll give a quick speech and then we'll wrap it up. But please give a round to our wonderful, gracious panelists. Thank you, gentlemen and lady.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.